Reclaiming Christianity, Episode 8, Speaking Christian. Reclaiming Christianity is generously supported by our patrons. Check us out at patreon.com/John Weldy. Hello again, friends, and welcome to Reclaiming Christianity, the only Christian podcast where the host doesn't wear pants. I'm John Weldy, and I'm just a guy. I am no one of consequence, and the reason that I say that is because I don't have this fancy pedigree. I don't have a theology degree. I'm not a professor at some place. I haven't written a whole bunch of books. And I really don't feel like I need to. The pedigrees are a big deal in our society right now, and it's like every podcast you listen to has got, well, this person is this author, and this person works for this company, and this person is it. And every time you see a conference speaker, it's like they've got a big bio with all of their accomplishments. And I think of what Paul said. And Paul was a guy that had lots and lots and lots of accomplishments. And he said, I have determined to know nothing but Christ and him crucified. And if anybody could have a pedigree, it would be Paul in Christianity. And I mean, that's a whole other conversation we could have about what is the Christianity of Paul, and is that different than the Christianity of Jesus? Oh man, that's a fun one to get into. But I'm not going to say that pedigrees are a bad thing. I'm not going to say it's a bad thing if you're a pastor or if you're a professor or if you've written books. I don't think it's a bad thing, but I think there is power in every person. What I believe about Christianity is not something for the powerful. It's not for the people at the top of that power pyramid, but it is for every person, and Christianity sets us free. Christianity liberates us, and it allows us to partake. It allows us to participate. I believe that Jesus Christ himself asks us to participate in the great awakening and the great work of redemption. And it's more beautiful and more powerful and more imaginative and more participative than anything that we could ever imagine. That's the Christianity I know. That's why I'm still a Christian. That's why I still claim the term. There's a lot of people like me. There's a lot of people I associate with that do not claim the term anymore, and I think that's fine. If you believe that Christianity is so out of control that you don't want to associate with it anymore, that's fine. There are many, many people, we talked about this a couple episodes ago, there are many, many people that have left the church but have not left their faith, and that's fine. That's fine. So I'm in the middle of the intro, and I started getting off on a complete tangent. So if you want to talk back to me, you can talk back to me. I just started a new Facebook group. Look under Reclaiming Christianity on Facebook, and you'll be able to find my Facebook group. It's a closed group. You can join it if you're a listener of this podcast, or you can just go to facebook.com/group/Reclaiming Christianity. You could also talk back if you got something that you want to say, because I don't want this to just be me talking. I realize that that's the mode of a podcast, but I would love if you guys would join in on the conversation. I would love if you would join on the Facebook group, if you would send me emails, if you would chat with me, if you would start your own podcast. I think that's amazing. I would love, my idea of success for this podcast is not if I have a million listeners. It's if I have 20 other podcasts that start up, little living room podcasts that start up because of what I'm doing. I think that's awesome. I want you to do what it is that I'm doing. You can also talk back to me at johnweldy@gmail.com. I'm going to start off here with a segment I'm going to call, Hey John, what you reading? And you know that I'm really big into books on this podcast, and I love reading, and I want to encourage you to read. And I just realized I've got a stack of books right here of things that I'm reading a little bit of, you know, and I will tell you that I'm kind of a buffet reader. I read a little bit at a time, and I go between things, and I'll try to figure out. Just last night, I had some time when I sat down and read, and I posted it on my Facebook page. I was like, okay, so which one of these should I read? What do you guys think? Because I love that participation, you know. I love to see what people have to say and their opinions. And So I'll tell you a little bit about the books that I'm reading right now, things that I'm in the middle of. And I will tell you that this podcast, one thing that this podcast has done for me is I have, since I've started doing this podcast 6 weeks ago, I have finished a lot more books than I ever finished before. Because I'm that type of person who loves to start reading something and then it's like, oh, a bunny. And I go off this way and I read something else, you know, that interests me. But these are the books that I'm reading right now. So you guys know already that I'm in the middle of Marcus Borg's Evolution of the Word. This is the one that if the one thing that I've been saying only on this podcast is I want to start up a book club that is going over Marcus Borg's Evolution of the Word. This is the New Testament in the order it was written and with some commentary by Marcus Borg. And he talks about how the New Testament evolved. The New Testament changed over the course of the, 30 to 90 years that it was written and how things changed. I think it's wonderful. It's amazing. And I would love to dig into that with some people. So that's one of the things I've been reading. There's also Kurt Vonnegut. You guys read Kurt Vonnegut? I honestly don't read a whole lot of fiction. It's just who I am. I don't naturally read a whole lot of fiction. It took a lot for me to read The Shack. And The Shack is one of my favorite books. I know you're getting sick of me saying it's my favorite book. But I absolutely love The Shack. It showed me a whole new way of picturing who God is. And it's not like it's not in the Bible. It's just sometimes you need those lenses to be able to see. And so I had read, in high school, I read Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, and I really, really liked it. I loved the craziness in it, and I loved the weird sci-fi that he put into it, being unstuck in time. And I started reading Cat's Cradle, because I keep getting, I'm around several different groups of people that are religious or ex-religious, and when Vonnegut comes up, Cat's Cradle keeps coming up, and I see why. Vonnegut has his own religion, Bokanism, that he, or however, I don't know how to pronounce it, Bokanism, that he made for this book, and it's fantastic. It's really, really cool. It may be something that I'll dig into sometime in the future. There's another book that I'm reading called The Fall of the Evangelical Nation: The Surprising Crisis Inside the Church. This is probably one that will end up on the podcast at some point in time. It's written by it's about 10 years old, so it was in the wake of George W. Bush, but this book doesn't know anything about Donald Trump at this point. But it's written by a religion reporter, Christine Wicker, and she talks about how the religious right is not nearly as big as we think that they are. And it's really fantastic. And everybody knows that church attendance is going down, but what she's saying is that the rumors of their numbers have been greatly exaggerated, and it's a very interesting book. And I'm about maybe a third of the way into that right now. And then there's also one other that I'm reading, which is called The Essence of Rumi. Rumi is a 13th century Muslim saint and mystic. His work is often compared to Dante and Shakespeare. Some people read Rumi as a poet. Some people read Rumi as a mystic. Some people read Rumi as a prophet. But there is some wonderful, wonderful 13th century poetry, wisdom literature, whatever you want to call it. I think it's absolutely fantastic. And I've just kind of dipped my toes into that a little bit. And last night I happened to dig into that because last night I was out at an event held locally here in Indianapolis that was held by Carmel Christian Church, which is a Disciples of Christ church. Disciples of Christ is a very open, you might say, progressive denomination, and they held an event called Know Your Neighbor, and this is something that's going on for 5 weeks, and they're bringing in people from a different religion every week, and we had 30 or 40 people last night crammed into a Panera Bread to listen to one of my Sikh friends, K.P. Singh, was speaking and talking about the Sikh faith, and it was lovely. It was amazing. I've gone out and visited the Sikh Gurdwara myself, one of the local Sikh. They don't call it a temple. They call it a Gurdwara, and I'm probably murdering the pronunciation of that, but I might have it right there. And I think they're lovely, lovely people, and I really enjoyed being with a crowd of Christians that are learning about other faiths. I think it's just wonderful. I think it's wonderful because the more you know about other people, the more you realize they're not the enemy. People are people. No matter who you are, no matter what you believe, people are people. I believe that there's very, very few people in the world. I think they exist, but I think there's very, very few people in the world who are just a-holes. I think most people, they have different motivations. And I mean, we know that our media and our government can spin things, obviously, right? So this week, I want to talk about something. Oh, hey, I got it working. I finally found the part in my program where I can see how much time I've gone through. So it's not just beats and I have to guess how much time I've gone through. So I actually have a timer running this week and I see I've gone through 10 minutes already just on the warm up on the intro. This week, we're going to talk about, I'm finally going to get to the chapter in Speaking Christian that talks about sin. And this is a big, big, big thing. This really goes to the heart of a whole bunch of theology. I mean, Marcus Borg in this book, Speaking Christian, talks about it in terms of sin. But what he really does, he frames the story of salvation, the story of why we need some kind of a rescue, what people need, and it's different stories for different people. And I think it's wonderful the way that he gets into that in a few of his books. He gets into that in Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time, which is the first book that I covered in this podcast, and I think it's fantastic. We've gotten this thing in evangelicalism where we have sin being something that is genetic. Yeah, I mean, people literally say that sin is in our DNA, and I think that's absolute garbage. But it dominates that we owe a debt from the sin, from the bad things that we do, and we owe a debt that Jesus is willing to pay. And that's narrative definitely is in the biblical narrative. It's there, but it's not the only narrative, and that's what we're going to get into. That's what we're going to get into in the book. But first, there was something very interesting that went on this week that I want to talk to you guys about a little bit, and I want to bring your attention to, because it's something that, as I was thinking this through, well, first off, this absolutely floored me. So what happened? There's this random church that you've never heard of before called Grace Point Community. It's a very generic name for a church, right? This is a church in Houston, Texas. The pastor is Don Keithley. Don Keithley also runs something called Global Grace Seminary. So in the world that I've gotten into in Christianity, there's different ways that people teach, different things that they focus on, this idea of penal substitutionary atonement, this idea of a wrathful God, has really gotten into American evangelicalism, and the picture of God that I have gotten in the past few years is completely different than that. And that's the only reason why I still call myself Christian, because I cannot deal with that wrathful God anymore. I do not believe in that God. I'm an atheist for that God. And because of people like Don Keithley, because of people like Steve McVeigh, because of people like Leo Hare, because of people like Brian Zond, Brad Jersak, John Crowder, because of people like this, these are people that teach about God in a different way. These are people that teach about the Christian God in ways that are very orthodox, but they're not evangelical. They're not Calvinist. They're not really where the American church has gone today. They're not about a wrathful God. They're about a God who is so much bigger than that, so much better than that. And so there's really not a whole lot of churches that teach that. And this is what Don's church teaches, and he holds conferences and things like that. Now, I'm really kind of out of the conference loop. I am sick of the conference. I was very, very into the conference loop at one time, especially when I was in the charismatic church. And I loved, loved, loved my time in the charismatic church. And I completely jumped into it with both feet. And I went to tons and tons of conferences over the course of a few years that I was really into this culture. And I think it was a great experience. And I found something real. I found something experiential. I found something that I cannot explain, but I cannot deny. And it's something that if I try to explain it on this podcast, which I will at some point, but if I try to explain some of the experiences that I had on this podcast, you're going to go, dude, you are crazy. you need to go and check yourself in at the Funny Farm, man. And I know that. I know that some of the things that I believe, some of the things that I have experienced defy logic, that they are completely paradigm shifting, that they are paradoxes. And I understand that. But I can't deny them either at the same time. I have experienced what I believe is the goodness, the true, pure goodness of God, love, creator, breath, in a way that I can't even, there's no words to describe it. And it's just amazing to me. And that's what Don and these other teachers are doing. And so Don, so I have said for a while, about a year ago, I took a trip to Nashville area. I'm in Indianapolis. And so Nashville is about, I can't remember, four or five hours away, something like that. And I took a trip to see a few different friends. And I was really looking, at that time, I hadn't been a part of a traditional church. I told you my story before where I really feel that the Spirit of God led me out of churches to investigate. It's hard to say. See, this is one of the things, because church is such a paradigm in the United States that it's really hard to find the language. It's really hard to find the words and explain it, because you've got it drummed into your head so much that you have to do this, you have to do this, you have to do this. And the answer is no, you don't have to do that. Christians, I want to talk to you right now. And I know there's some people listening to this podcast that aren't Christians, but Christians, I want to talk to you right now. And I want to say some things that are going to shock you, and you might shut this podcast off. Christians, you don't have to go to church. You don't have to read your Bible. You don't have to pray. You don't have to follow the Ten Commandments. All that stuff, you don't have to do it. And in fact, I'll even go so far as to say that if you do it because you think you have to do it, doesn't mean anything. It's just guilt and shame piling on top of guilt and shame. If you don't want to do it, don't do it. That'll get me in trouble. But so when I went to Nashville, Tennessee to see some friends, I was looking for people that did church in a different way. And there was this one guy that I talked to that is kind of a leader on the movement. I'm not going to say his name right now. People that know who I'm talking about know who I'm talking about, and I don't need to say his name. But this person that I met is kind of a leader on the front of doing church in a different way and not doing a church in a traditional building and guiding other people into this place of exile, really, you know, where the exile, where maybe you realize that the exile really is a freedom. But, you know, it can be a very lonely place because that paradigm is all over in the church. And what I really found, both in meeting this guy and in some other groups that I found that are in the same type of thing where they're finding different ways to do church, a lot of people will call it the house church movement or an unchurching movement, or they don't really call it an anti-church movement, you know, but just doing church in a different way, doing church in a small group movement. You know, without an institutional, non-institutional church movement, something like that. And what I've found is that a lot of people in the movement like this are very, very rigid and conservative and fundamentalist with their faith still. And they haven't found that freedom. And so I talked to this person, and I told him that I'm a heretic on two different fronts. I'm a heretic theologically, and I'm a heretic with my ecclesiology. Ecclesiology is the way that you do church. Theology is the way that you believe and think about God. And so many of these people that I was with, and I'm talking about individuals and also groups that I was a part of, they were willing to take big steps and do things different as far as ecclesiology, as far as doing church in a different way, but their theology did not change in any way. And so, in fact, in some ways, their theology dug in even deeper, and I could not deal with that. because I had been changed. I had found freedom. And really, I found freedom first through the theology before the ecclesiology. And I had found that so many people in this movement were not like that. That so many people in this movement had found the reason that they are trying to find freedom, and the reason they can't find it, that all they're finding is loneliness in their ecclesiology, is because their theology is messed up. Because they're not finding freedom in their theology in the way that they think about God, but instead they're digging in deeper. And that's not good. That's why there's so many people that will abandon Christianity altogether. And I mean, I was almost one of those for a while. I mean, because when you really follow the wind, when you really follow what the Spirit of God is saying to you, and you really take it serious, I mean, it'll take you some weird places, some places that your training and your experience never taught you that it was okay to go. And so I told this guy that I'm a heretic on two fronts with both my ecclesiology and my theology, and it's so different from most of the people in that world. But I found one person in that trip, my friend Chuck Crisco, who is an amazing, amazing friend. He's one of a very small number of people that's the closest thing to a mentor I have right now. And I love this guy so much because he gets it. He gets it. He is doing church in a different way, and he's teaching in a different way. He's seeing God in a different way, and everything, all of this. And it's amazing. And he, in this conversation that I had with him and the relationship I've had with him ever since, he's one of the most loving, caring, wonderful people that I've ever had the opportunity to work with. He's a good friend. He's a really good friend. And so back to Don Keithley and Grace Point Community. So there's this message, and Don's website is churchisfun.org. And I'll be really honest with you, I had a problem with Don for a good time. Don's kind of been in the circle that I've been a part of for a while, but what I really thought about Don and Grace Point is, well, they get the theology message, but man, they're not finding that freedom in the ecclesiology at all. They're still plugging along every week in a big building, paying a whole ton of money, and it's so inefficient, and it's old, and it's dying out, and it's not reaching anybody except for preaching to the choir the way it's always been. And that's what I really felt. I'm not saying that that's right. I'm saying that that's what I really felt. And so the first time I saw Don's website, churchisfun.org, I kind of laughed, yeah, whatever, church is fun. Okay, whatever, right. Of course it's fun. Ha ha. But something that happened this past week really gave me pause. I've heard a lot of, well, I shouldn't say a lot of people. I've heard a few people that start spreading this message of a God who is better than this institutional, capitalistic, warmongering God that we have in America. There are some voices that are growing along those lines. And I said some of their names before on here. I said some of their names a little bit earlier. There are voices that are growing on that front. And there are many of us that will not put up with that picture of God anymore. The Republican Jesus with a rifle in one hand and a Bible in the other. We won't put up with that anymore. We can't. Because we've experienced what's real. It's not just because we don't think that's right. It's because we know that that's not what's right. But we also cannot abandon our faith and be atheists or go to another religion or be agnostic or be secular humanists. You know, there's nothing wrong with secular humanism. I think secular humanism is a beautiful, beautiful thing. Because to me, what I know of my friends who are secular humanists, what they believe is that this world right now is all we get, so let's make it beautiful. And I think that's the message of Jesus more than most Christians believe. Man, I could get into so many things with this. But anyhow, Don Keithley. So at Grace Point, they sold their building. Just up. Now, I don't know how long it was in the works, but that got my attention. when a church decides, oh, we're going to sell our building and we're going to do something different. And so this message that Don gave last week, if you listen to this message, I will tell you that the first maybe 20 minutes or so of this message seemed very, very traditional. And you're not going to see anything that you haven't seen before in it. And you're going to say, John, why are you having me listen to this guy? It's just the same as what. And honestly, I've had a couple friends that are not seeing the same thing in this message of Don's that I'm seeing. Some really good friends that I really thought would see what I'm seeing in this. But they're so burned out on people that say that the church is going to be different or they're going to start a movement. And they've seen it all before. But I feel that what Don and Grace Point are doing is different. It feels different to me from Indianapolis, from what I've seen of it. And I'll tell you, it doesn't feel different because I've trusted Don for a long time, because I just told you, I really haven't, you know, but something in my spirit really connects with what's going on here. And he got my attention in saying that this big campus that they've got, and they don't have a whole lot of people in the church, at least from what I understand, but this big campus they got, they're selling it. They don't know what that's going to look like. And they are going to have some kind of an online gathering, conglomeration, community. They don't know what it looks like. What I really got in listening to Don's message is that we don't know what it's going to look like, but we know it can't look like this. And when I heard that, when I heard the gist of that, that it was amazing to me, because that's the very same thing that I felt in my spirit for years. I don't know what it's going to look like, but it can't look like what it looks like now. And that really goes. So I say that this, the reason that I'm talking about this is it ties together several different topics that we've talked about on this podcast. So it talks about going back to episode 2 with Flickering Pixels, with the media is the message. So when you listen to Don's message, and I really encourage you to go take a look at that, look up Don Keithley, Grace Point Community, or look up churchesfun.org, look up the message from this past week, which is going to be, let me get the date. I don't even know what the date today is. The 4th. 3rd, 2nd, 1st, so it's September 30th, October 1st, whichever one was a Sunday, September 30th, October 1st. Look up the message on churchesfun.org. And I will tell you that the first part of it, the media is the message. That's the message of Flickering Pixels, the second episode of this website, this podcast. If you haven't listened to it, go back and take a look at it. But you'll absolutely see on this video that Don has, the graphics look like just about any church you've seen on TV or whatever. The background, the way Don's dressed up, the way Don's hair is fixed, like it doesn't look any different. It looks the same, you know? And so the media is the message. So even though Don is putting out, and I just told you, Don is teaching different things about who God is, and he's teaching a different way to relate with God, because the media is still showing, it still looks the same. People are not getting it, because people still show up to church and pack in every single week, and it's the same thing every week. People are not getting it. It's spreading. It is spreading, and there is a movement, and especially through this seminary that Don started, which is really the first of its kind of teaching in this way. But I will tell you that Don's message is different. And the first thing when I listened to this, and honestly, because as you listen to the first 20 minutes or so of Don's message, I said it's very similar to stuff that you've seen before, and I came close to turning it off myself, but then Don said one thing that really, really, boom, got my attention. He said, a traditional church model and the message we teach, they do not mix. A traditional church model and what we do, they are oil and water. And I was like, dude, you got it. Right there, you've got it. And you know what? I've heard people say these things before in church, not very often. But I have heard people say these things before at church and then keep doing the same thing over and over and over and over and not changing. So the thing that got my attention is they're changing. And it feels sudden to me. I don't know. I haven't really been invested in their culture. Maybe it's not sudden. But they're going big. They're putting all the chips in on the table, and they don't know what it's going to look like. And it may crash and burn, and it may be horrible and awful. But man, that's what's awesome about it. Because they're not doing the same old thing. It also ties in, we talked in episode 6 about church refugees, about why people leave the church. So Don talked about that a whole lot in his message also. And I've talked with Don a little bit since then. He joined the ex-evangelical group. And I'll tell you, Don is still solidly in the institutional church paradigm. And so the ex-evangelical group, for him, this is a group of ex-evangelicals. This is not a Christian group. And I highly encourage any of you who used to be evangelical Christians and you've got some baggage to deal with that, I highly encourage you to check out this group. Just look up ex-evangelical on Facebook. And so Don looked in here, and Don does come from an institutional mindset, and it's completely different to him. And I knew it was going to be. I knew it was going to be. It's changing. And Don's an older guy than I am. You know, I'm a Gen Xer. Don's a baby boomer. You know, and I have huge, 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 huge respect for somebody who's a baby boomer, who's supposed to be going off, riding off into the sunset, into retirement, that's starting something so big and so different. I don't think he realizes how big and how different it is. And so it also ties in the concepts from Sapiens that we talked about. One of the concepts in Sapiens that we didn't really talk about last week was the world coming together in unity. In the book, Yuval Noah Harari talks about three different forces that have brought together the world in unity. And I'm probably going to spend a whole other podcast on this, but I want to give you the quick version of it really here. He talks about three forces that have brought unity to the world. I mean, originally, you know, way back millions of years ago, we had all these different pockets of Homo sapiens. And gradually, over the course of time, over the course of prehistory and over the course of history, we have grown to where now we are one world. We still have nations. And he talks, of course, about nations don't exist. That's that imagination thing that we're talking about. I mean, if you haven't read this, you are in for a thrill. Go back and listen to episode 7, Sapiens. Because it will knock your freaking socks off, I'm telling you. But Yuval Noah Harari talks about three forces that bring unity, that have brought unity to the world: empire, money, and religion. Now, religion is one of them, but it's the least of them. Empire, obviously, it's not necessarily a good thing, you know, but the various empires, the Roman Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the American Empire, we have definitely brought together the world, and money is the biggest thing. Money makes the world go around right now. There are people right now who are, well, especially over the past 30 years or so since the Cold War, 50 years since the Cold War in the 60s to the 80s, there are people that are so terrified of nuclear war. I'm not. And I'll be honest with you, part of that is because I believe in a good God, but an even bigger part of it is because I believe in the almighty buck. I don't necessarily believe in it for myself, but I know that that's the power that holds the world together right now. And I don't think anybody's going to press that button because they need the trade. They need people to be trading partners. And so these forces have brought the world together in unity. And I believe we're only looking for more and more unity. I think this Gene Roddenberry world of Star Trek is coming. It's on the horizon. I can see it. And when you look at it from the lens of theology, when you get rid of the crap theology of the rapture, dispensationalism, of Jesus coming back to slaughter people and take the Christians away so that they'll be safe, when you get rid of all that garbage, which that's what it is. It's garbage. I mean, we can go into it at some other time, you know, but I'm just going to tell you that's garbage. It's toxic. When you get rid of all of that And you can see a God who is bringing things together. I'm going to show you just a couple things in Scripture. So in Acts 17, 28, Paul says about God, he's talking about God through some of the poets of the Romans, of the Greeks. And he says, in him we live and move and have our being. There's a phrase that I really, really like. It's not scripture, but it's a phrase to describe God as this ground of all being. And it says, we are in God as fish are in water. I love that. I love that. There's also 2 Corinthians 5:19. It says, God was in Christ reconciling the cosmos, reconciling the world to himself, reconciling the entire world to himself. And I see that workings. I see the workings of that right now about how the world has been coming together and the world is getting to be a better and better place. There's a lovely book, a very, very long book by Steven Pinker called The Better Angels of Our Nature that shows we tend to think it's so easy to see doom and gloom because the media focuses on sensationalism, and it's so much easier to get a bad story about bad stuff going on than a good story about good stuff going on. But when you look at the long term and you look about, there's just about every single measurable for the way life is going that is better now than it's ever been in the entire history of the world. There's another passage. This is from Colossians chapter 1. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created. In Christ, all things were created. Things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body of the church. He is the beginning and firstborn from among the dead, so that in all things he may have preeminence. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things. Reconciling all things, everything is being reconciled. Not just people that say, oh, I believe in Jesus. I check those boxes. Not just humans, but all things being reconciled. For God was pleased to have his fullness dwell in him and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through the blood of his cross. The powers that Yuval Noah Harari sees bringing unity to the world are empire, money, and religion. I think that's true. I think that's true. I think those powers have definitely brought unity to the world. But I think there's also a power, I'll call that power Christ, but some may call it the cosmic Christ, because this is a Jesus, or it's not, maybe not even a Jesus. Jesus is a historical figure. This is a Christ that is an energy, that is a force, that is a power above all things, through which all things were created and holds everything together, and through which all things are coming into reconciliation, coming into a unity of being. Different people will call that different things. I call it Christ. But that's what I see. Don and Grace Point get this. They're not just saying it, they're doing it. They're going out on a limb, and I think it's amazing. And it may be, who knows what's going to happen with it. It may crash and burn. They may come back to the landing spot and nothing really happens, or it may be the beginning of something that is greater than anything we've ever seen. I think it's great. Don, my hat's off to you, friend. So I want to get into Marcus Borg speaking Christian, and I got to take a drink here for a minute. And so I'm going to talk about, so it's still on this same page. The reason why I talked about some of these things, we're talking about all the same thing. So this theology that I just talked about, that I brought together things from a few different podcasts that I've done, this idea of Christ being all in all, this Christ force, this cosmic Christ that is before everything. We are in God as fish are in water. And God is in us. He's our very breath. Some call it God, some call it Christ, some call it something completely different. But this idea, this is the God that I'm talking about. This is the God that, this is not Republican Jesus. This is not the God that the American evangelical religious right machine will talk to you about. They may give some lip service to pieces like this, but we got some serious problems with being entangled in politics. And Marcus Borg talks about a lot of that also. Now, there are probably differences between my theology and Marcus Borg's theology and Don Keithley's theology, but, you know, they're all pointed the same kind of direction. You know, everybody's going to be different, right? Right? So I don't want to say, I don't want to say that it's the exact same thing, but it definitely got me thinking. I thought that this was the right time to do this book because it fits in the same message. So without further ado, I'm going to start. This is a chapter on sin, the word sin in Marcus Borg's Speaking Christian. Sin is a very big word in heaven and hell Christianity. Within its framework of meaning, as we saw in chapter 1, sin is the central issue in our life with God. We have sinned and need forgiveness, and Jesus' death provides the basis for our forgiveness. So I'm going to pause here for just a second. So in this book, Marcus Borg is describing different words. If you want to go back to episode 4, which I first got into this book, Marcus Borg is describing different words that are in Christianity. This word is sin, but there are different words in Christianity that have completely lost their meaning, completely lost their power, and he's putting us back onto the radar. He's reclaiming it. The book is called Speaking Christian, Why Christian Words Have Lost Their Meaning and Power and How They Can Be Restored. And so he's giving this bigger picture of God, this bigger picture of Christ, and he contrasts that to what he calls heaven and hell Christianity. It's what I have called American evangelicalism, but I mean, difference of terms, same type of thing that we're talking about. Back to the text. This emphasis on sin as the central issue and forgiveness as our central need is very old, the product of the process of accommodating Christianity to dominant culture that began in the 4th century when the Emperor Constantine adopted it. The result is that sin became the primary metaphor for describing the human condition, the human predicament. Given that problem, what we need most of all is forgiveness. Much of this chapter is a critique of what happens when the multiple and powerful biblical metaphors are reduced to sin as the one dominant metaphor, the macro metaphor for what ails us. Because of this chapter's critical edge, I emphasize at the outset that sin matters. It is one of the Bible's major metaphors for the human condition, but it is one of several, and not only one. So the question is not, does sin matter? It does. And crucially, it matters how we think of sin. Is it the macro metaphor in our understanding of our life with God? If so, how has that affected our life with God? What do we think sin means in both singular and plural form? What is sin and what are sins? So this is the intro to the chapter. This is what I was talking about. So this message, and this is what he's going to get across here in the chapter. I'm front loading this a little bit. This message of sin and being redeemed from sin, being quote unquote saved from sin, whatever that means, it matters. Shit happens. I do stuff wrong all the time, right? I make mistakes. That there's evil in the world, there's problems, you know, that matters. But we have turned Christianity into that's all that matters, and that's not biblical. That's not what is in the biblical text. Let's go back to this text here. Demoting sin. Sin needs to be demoted from its status as the dominant Christian metaphor for what's wrong among us. As noted above, it is not the only biblical image for the human condition, but one of several. Moreover, it is not the primary one, not the most important one, not even a first among equals. Rather, it is a peer among several major metaphors. Demoting sin enables us to see the power and importance of the other metaphors. Ultimately, it also enriches our understanding of sin. In the story of what led to Israel's bondage in Egypt, sin is not an issue at all. The ancestors of the Jewish people were not in slavery because they had sinned. As slaves, what they needed was not forgiveness, but liberation. Imagine that the story offered them forgiveness but left them in bondage. That would be a very different story. In Israel's experience of exile in Babylon, sin does play a part. Some biblical texts say that the exile happened because of sin, but sin is not the primary image used for their predicament. Exile was their problem. Forcibly removed from their beloved homeland, taken to an alien land named Babylon, and controlled by their conquerors, they lived constricted and impoverished lives, virtually as slaves. What they needed was not primarily forgiveness, though that is present in the story, but a path out of exile, a way to return home. It meant leaving Babylon and journeying on the way through the wilderness, much of it desert. Is sin the primary metaphor of the story? No. If our problem is exile, we need a path of return. We need the way of the Lord, as Isaiah 40, verse 3 puts it. This phrase from Isaiah, with its resonance of exile and return, is used by Matthew, Mark, and Luke as they introduce their stories of Jesus. The way of the Lord is one of their crystallizations of what the story of Jesus is about. The image is found in what maybe the best-known parable of Jesus, the prodigal son, Luke 15, 11 through 32. The younger son goes to a distant country. He becomes an exile. In exile, his life becomes so miserable that he finally comes to himself and resolves to return, to journey back to his father. Though the son prepares a confession of sin, the father doesn't need to hear it. Indeed, the father sees the son a long way off and, filled with compassion, rushes out to meet him. This parable is not a story about sin and forgiveness. Think of how different the story would be if the son had received forgiveness in exile and yet remained in a distant country, working for a pig farmer. Nothing had changed, except that he had been forgiven and felt better. Would anybody bother to remember a story like that? Rather than being a story about sin and forgiveness, it is about exile, return, welcome, and celebration. Do you see what's going on here? We're so used to this idea of sin. Jesus came and died for my sins. It's my sin. It's personal sin. It's sin, 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 sin. We're so used to this being the primary narrative. Is there sin in this story about the prodigal son? Sure. Did the prodigal son screw up? Sure. But he put himself into exile. And he didn't just need to be forgiven. The end of the story of the prodigal son, the father welcomes him back with open arms. He's waiting and watching for him at the gate. He'd been watching every day to see when his son would return. And he has a feast when he returns. He welcomes him with open arms. This is the picture of the father welcoming us from our exile, not from our sin. Welcoming us home from our exile. This is a message we need to understand. It's not always about sin. Sometimes it's about exile and being welcomed home. And sometimes it's about something else as we return to the text. Yet another biblical image for the human condition is infirmity. In its manifold forms, illness, blindness, paralysis, a bent and burdened back, deafness, woundedness. What the infirm need is not forgiveness, but healing and wholeness. As John 9 says in the story of Jesus healing a blind man, the infirm are not infirm because they or their parents sinned. Infirmity is not about sin, and thus forgiveness would miss the point. When sin becomes the one-size-fits-all metaphor for the human condition, it obscures the rich and important meanings of these other metaphors. According to the Bible, our predicament, what we need deliverance from, is not simply or primarily sin. There are other issues such as bondage, exile, blindness, infirmity, hard-heartedness, and so forth. For these, forgiveness is not the answer. People in bondage need liberation from the Pharaoh who rule their lives. People in exile need to leave Babylon and return home. People who are blind need to see. People who are sick or wounded need healing. People who are outcast need community. But the heaven and hell Christian emphasis on sin and forgiveness casts these meanings into shadow, eclipsed by sin. This hits me hard. This really hits me. Because when I look around at where we are in this country today, are we a Christian nation? Man, there's so many different things that can mean. I will say, we are a nation that's in the place that we are because 81% of evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. We are a nation that is in the place that we are because the religious right voted in George W. Bush. We're in the nation that we are because for some strange reason, the way that politics and religion intermingle, where, I mean, I've seen pictures this week. This week we had a mass shooting in Las Vegas where this guy killed more than 60 people and injured 500 more. The guns are out of control in this country. And you may say it's not guns, it's people. Well, it's both. But even more than that, you're right, it's ideology. And we as Christians have a lot to answer for that. Because we have allowed the cross to get mixed up with the M16. We have entangled the cross and the flag to where if you supposedly show disrespect for the flag, you're also showing disrespect for the cross. We forget that the message of Jesus is intensely political. And it's not nationalist. It's about people liberating, setting free, breaking free from an empire that we are so entangled in ourselves right now. For some reason, the cross is mixed up with the military. We spend, what's the figure? I think it's we spend more on our military than the next 8 countries combined. Out of control. And this is a cycle. I mean, this is nothing new. You can trace why we spend so much on our military. You can trace that back to World War II. You know, we ramped up the machine in World War II 70 years ago, 75 years ago, and we have not ramped it down yet. Why? Well, first it was because of Russia. Because we were scared of Russia. We got in the Cold War. It's nuclear. We got to have power. And then when Russia folded, all of a sudden, the Arab world is a problem. When you start tracing this scarlet thread throughout history of why we spend so much on military, and I'm not going to get into it right now, bit by bit and piece by piece, but when you trace this thread about why we spend so much on our military and why we turn war into a business. We turn war into a video game. We don't understand what I was saying earlier about meeting our neighbors. We don't understand that those people over there are just like us people over here. We get so wrapped up in our nationalism. We're so great. We're so amazing. And we've got to protect it with all these weapons, that we don't realize all the damage we're doing. Are mass shootings because of guns? Yes. Are they because of ideology? Yes. Are they because of ideology about guns? Yes. Are they because of... Are they because of the mess that we have gotten into with the cross and the flag being entangled? Yes. We need to change, guys. And this is exactly what he is saying. This is what Marcus Borg is saying in this book. When we make the single issue sin, and we elevate sin to the whole issue for the Bible, then we get into things like making laws that gay people can't get married. And we make that the most important thing. Don't they deserve liberation? If there is a people, there are so many people groups. I'm not going to say any one of them more than others. People of color, LGBTQ, Muslims. There are so many different people groups in this country that are in exile. They need to be freed. They don't need to be told, you are sinning. You are doing the wrong thing, but that's what we focus on. They need to be freed. They need to be allowed to come home. Let's go back to the text. Sin and sins. In the Bible and in post-biblical Christianity, the term appears in both singular and plural form, sin and sins. When used in the plural, it most often means particular failures such as disobedience to God's will and infractions against God's commands. Some Christians understand this as missing the mark, with the mark understood as God's commands. We miss the mark by disobeying God's commands again and again. When this is the case, forgiveness is the imperative need. This understanding commonly goes with the individualization of sin, that sins, plural, are acts of wrongdoing committed by individuals. Of course, it is true that we as individuals do commit sins and miss the mark, but this focus on sin as the wrongful acts of individuals misses the fuller and richer biblical meanings of sin. The Bible does speak about sin as something that individuals do, but it also speaks about, to use modern language, institutionalized sin, systemic sin, sin built into the structures of society. There is a collective corporate sin. Oh my God, yes, there is. This is the problem with us. And this is John talking again, not Marcus Borg. This is what we do. We make it all about Jesus and me. This is what, I love books, but this is what the printed word does. It makes it all about Jesus and me, where there is a collective sin. There is systemic sin that needs to be rectified, that we need to be set free of, that we need to bring down the walls. In Micah 1:5, the prophet rhetorically asks what the transgression of Jacob, the northern kingdom of Israel, is. His answer is that the sin of Israel is Samaria, and the sin of Judah, the southern kingdom, it is Jerusalem. Sin as cities? Samaria and Jerusalem were the capitals of the northern and southern kingdoms, and thus the centers of monarchy and domination. The ruling elite had built sin into the very structures of society. This is sin as systemic injustice and systemic violence. Do the elite need forgiveness for this? Yes. But what is also needed is a change in the system. Sin in the singular is also used in the Bible to refer to a power that holds us in bondage. Here, sin is not primarily about individual acts of wrongdoing, but refers to a power that rules us, a pharaoh within, who controls us and refuses to let us go. Paul writes eloquently about sin as a power in Romans 7:7-24. Sin produced in me all kinds of covetousness. Sin deceived me. I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. It is is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. I can will what is right, but I cannot do it. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I do. Now if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. It is no longer I who do it is not meant as an excuse. Rather, it is a recognition of what many people know in their experience, that we are often not free, but captives. When sin is bondage, as it is here, the remedy is not forgiveness, but liberation from bondage. The nature of sin is in the singular has been insightfully named in various ways by Christian thinkers over the century. One influential stream of Christian wisdom understands the root of sin from which sins in the plural flow is hubris, a Greek word commonly translated into English as pride. Pride is somewhat misleading because in ordinary usage today, pride can sometimes be good or at least okay. When a person says, "I felt proud of myself when I fill in the blank," that might be fine. Many people suffer from low self-esteem, and thus sometimes feeling good about oneself is good. But hubris means much more than this. It means puffing oneself up to inordinate size, attempting to become godlike. It means making oneself the center of the universe and the center of one's concern. This is characteristic not only of world conquerors and extreme narcissists, but it is the universal, or at least virtually universal, product of normal human development. Early in the process, from infancy into childhood and adulthood, we become aware of the self-world distinction, that the self and the world are separate. This is the birth of self-awareness. All of us experience this. The natural result, meaning virtually inevitable and perhaps completely so, is self-concern. The world is not only separate from us, but not completely reliable, even dangerous. And so we become focused on the self and its well-being. This happens to all of us. Hubris infects not only individuals, but also groups, countries, and humanity itself. Groups often puff themselves up to inordinate size, overestimating their own importance and causing conflict in society because they believe they have a monopoly on the truth. Boy, that doesn't sound like anybody you know, does it? Having a monopoly on the truth? Countries do too. Think of the total allegiance they sometimes demand, and empires do. The fatal flaw that causes the downfall of empires is overreaching themselves, imagining that their power and control are invulnerable. They imagine there is nothing they cannot do. Hubris is also a characteristic of humanity as a whole. As the ecological crisis has made us aware, for millennia, we have imagined ourselves to be the center and climax of creation. We have treated the earth as if it belongs to us, as if the non-human world is there solely for our own benefit. All of this is hubris. Hubris is a powerful image for sin in the singular. It accounts for many and perhaps all sins in the plural, which stem from self-concern and concern for the security of the self on both the individual and societal level. A primary concern with the well-being of one's group or country often leads to injustice and violence. So what he's saying is, when you think your little group, your tribe, your people, your nation is better than everybody else, it causes problems. Yeah. A second image of the root of sin initially seems like its opposite. Sin is not as hubris, but as sloth. But they are not incompatible opposites. Rather, they are complementary. In a metaphor that I owe to one of theologian Harvey Cox's many perceptive books, sloth means leaving it to the snake. The reference is to Adam and Eve in the garden, letting the serpent tell them what to do. Within the framework of this metaphor, their sin was not hubris, not puffing themselves up to inordinate size, but slothfully and complacently accepting what the snake told them to do. Sin is sloth, is letting others decide your life for you. You are going along with what you have heard, how things are. Like hubris, sloth is a root sin, singular, from which sins, plural, proceed. When hubris, centering on the self, is the problem, forgiveness is not the solution, or at least it's not an adequate remedy. A person brutally or miserably afflicted by self-centeredness can be forgiven and feel forgiven and still be unchanged, still a prisoner of hubris, so also a sloth. The remedy for hubris and sloth is a recentering of the self. We need to center ourselves in God, not in our own concerns or the lords or powers who rule this world. Centering in God is the way of the Lord, the path of return, liberation, and wholeness. Another very important root image for sin in the Bible is idolatry. In Christian usage, it has several meanings, some of which distort and trivialize it. For some Christians, it means the gods of other religions. Their gods are idols. Our God is the one true God. Sometimes among Protestants, idolatry has been associated with Catholics and the presence in their churches of statues and graven images of people other than Jesus, especially Mary and the saints. In the church in which I grew up, we took it for granted that Catholics were idolatrous because of their prodigal use of images. Indeed, they even prayed to Mary and the saints. But none of this expresses the biblical meaning of idolatry. Idolatry is a matter of lordship. Who is your Lord, the center of your allegiance? Yourself and those whom you love most dearly? Your group or your country? Humanity or God, who is more than all of this? Idolatry occurs when we make anything less than God the center of our lives. It encompasses both hubris and sloth. It is centering in something other than God and letting something other than God's passions shape our lives. So I want to pause here for just a moment. As I'm reading this, I have listeners in many different streams. I have listeners to this podcast, and I want to respect that. I have listeners to this podcast who are not Christians. I have listeners to this podcast, even though I call it Reclaiming Christianity, and I call it Reclaiming Christianity because I really do believe that Christianity is worth reclaiming, both me personally, reclaiming it for myself, and collectively, this societal thing that he's talking about, that we've gone off the rails, and I believe it's worth step by step reclaiming what Christianity really is supposed to be about. And I know that I have listeners who are pagan, who are other religions, who are, and when I say pagan, I don't use pagan as in the Bible. I mean actual pagan religion. And who are atheists, who are agnostic. And I'm just noticing that some of the language in this book, it's very Christian language. Even though he says that he's doing away with Christian language, there's a lot of God talk in this. And I just want to say to those of you who the God talk puts off a little bit, insert the word love. Anytime I use the word God, insert the word love. I have friends that I think are much closer to following the way of Jesus who are atheists than a lot of Christians that I know. I have friends that completely have sworn off God and anything to do with God, but they understand love. And in the way that I was brought up, in the fundamentalist Christian way, oh, nobody can love unless they're of God. I think that's bullshit. Or maybe it's absolutely true, and it's just your definition is bullshit. So don't be afraid of doing that. If I say the word God too much, don't be afraid to insert the word love, because to me, there's very few times when they're not interchangeable. Back to the text. From idolatry as centering in the finite flow, sins plural. Hence, the greatest commandment in both Old and New Testaments, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind. This more comprehensive understanding of sin is rich. It names what commonly ails us. At the same time, it does not become the one-size-fits-all description of us. For some people, indeed the majority of people who have ever lived, the issue is not so much that they sinned, but that they were sinned against. There are victims of sin as well as sinners. Victims of sin do not need forgiveness, although they may need to forgive, but they need liberation, reconnection, healing, wholeness, and a world of justice and peace. All of this is central to God's passion in the Bible as revealed decisively in Jesus. Within this broader biblical understanding of sin, forgiveness is not the primary antidote to sin. Rather, the primary antidote is a deeper and deeper centering in God, rather than centering in the self, hubris, or the lords of the world that tell us how to live, sloth. Both are forms of idolatry. The antidote is the opposite of idolatry. You shall love the Lord your God. A modest proposal. Christian language and liturgy need to speak not just about sins in the plural and our need for forgiveness. They also need to speak about sin as a power that holds us in bondage. They need to speak about the pharaohs who rule our lives, the Babylon in which we live as exiles, the self-concern that dominates us, the blindness and limited vision that is the natural product of growing up in a particular time and place. They need to speak about the ways we have been wounded, the ways we have wounded and been wounded, and our need for transformation and healing. But these other things, these other images of our predicament and our need are largely absent from contemporary Christian worship. In most churches, liturgical and non-liturgical, the issue is sin, understood primarily in the plural as infractions committed against God and our neighbors. In liturgical churches, a confession of sin and absolution, the pronouncement of forgiveness, are a standard part of worship. In non-liturgical churches, most of which are conservative, there may not be a standardized confession of sin and absolution, but it is still clear that sin is the central issue in our life with God. Our sins are the reason Jesus had to die. Imagine the difference it would make if Christian worship services also highlighted the other biblical images for what ails us. Imagine Christian liturgies and preaching that emphasizes that we are Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt and need liberation, that we are exiled in Babylon and need a path to return home, that we are blind and need to see again, that we are sick and wounded and need healing and wholeness, and yes, that we are sinners who need forgiveness. Imagine, to become more specific than I wish to be, that a confession of sin and absolution were part of the liturgy one Sunday out of five. Imagine that the other four Sundays, the confession of sin, were replaced by images of our predicament as bondage, exile, blindness, and infirmity. Imagine the absolution replaced by the proclamation that God wills our liberation from bondage, our return from exile, our seeing again, our healing and wholeness. Sin matters. But when it and the need for forgiveness become the dominant issue in our life with God, it reduces and impoverishes the wisdom and passion of the Bible and the Christian tradition. How about that? Can you even imagine what that would be like? See, I've been a Christian all my life. I spent decades in the institutional church, and it's always sin, 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 sin. What if we talked about liberation? What if we talked about return from exile? What if we talked about healing and wholeness? And I mean, I will grant them, when I was in the charismatic church, they did. They talked about that one. That was good. What if we talked about healing from blindness? And when we're talking about blindness, obviously, we don't just mean physical blindness. I think it's really easy to say that as a whole, Christianity in America right now is blind. What if we focused on the Bibles, on Jesus's, on God's plan for releasing us from that blindness, from healing us, giving us wholeness, from setting us free from bondage, and from letting us return home from our exile? What a beautiful world. What a beautiful world. If we could put sin in its proper place. Does it matter? Yeah. But what if it was 20% instead of 100%? I love Marcus Borg. The dude is amazing. He just really speaks to me. I hope he speaks to you also. So I want to close up here, and there's a couple things that I want to do as I'm closing up here. Man, I'm still on the Marcus Borg buzz. Got a little Marcus Borg drunk going on here. So I've got a couple reviews since the last time that we had an episode. I've received two reviews, and I'm going to open them up here so I can read them a little bit to you. If you want to talk back, please talk back. I told you you could talk back to me on my website, reclaimingchristianity.org. You can talk back. Look for Reclaiming Christianity group on Facebook, and you can talk back inside of that group, or you can leave me a review. You can send me an email at johnweldy@gmail.com. So I've gotten a couple reviews in the past week since we had our last episode. And I've got a 5-star rating now, guys. I've got enough reviews that I've got a rating. And I thank you guys so much. You guys are so awesome. You guys are so kind. I'm not going to say that I deserve a 5-star rating, and I know somebody's going to come along and completely destroy it, and that's fine. I'm fine. I'm fine with that. It's not about the rating, but you guys are just so awesome. I have the greatest listeners here. So I'm going to read a couple reviews that I've gotten since the last time that we had an episode. This first one is from Zach DP, and it says, "One of my favorites. I love John's passion and authenticity comes to life in this podcast. I wish I could read more than I do listening. So listening to him read small sections of these books and review them is perfect." That's a big reason, right? I haven't talked about that a whole lot in this podcast, but that's a big reason for why I do this podcast. I told you I'm not the guy with a pedigree. I'm not the guy that's written books. I'm not the guy that's the best book reviewer. I'm not the guy that's the best at analyzing books. I'm just a guy. I'm just an average. I'm just a guy like you are. I'm just a person. I'm no one of consequence. And that's my power, because I hope that you can see that, and I hope that you can see, and I know that there's a lot of people that don't read, and so I know I have a passion when I read, and if you listen to me read and you want to read it yourself, that's great. And if you listen to me read and you want to hear me read part of the next one of the podcast, that's great. It's awesome. It's all good. If you listen to me read and you want to hear Peter Rollins' audiobook, that's great. That's awesome. You know, the idea is not that you actually have to read words on a page, but we live in a world right now where you can have people read things to you as you're driving in your car. I listen to stuff in my car all the time, and it's fantastic. It's the ideas much more than the fact of reading. When I say reading, I don't just mean reading off of a page. There's many, many, many ways to interact with ideas. So another one, this one is from Lizzie D3. Thank you, Lizzie D3. Says, "Engaging, genuine, fun, love it. What's not to love about listening to John Weldy? I admire..." Oh, geez, I'm going to blush. "I admire him more than he knows. John has a heart of gold. He loves people and is not afraid to hear from and learn from them. Listening to the podcast reminds me that there is beauty in doubt, creativity in asking questions, and freedom in uncertainty. My mind and heart have been expanded, and I'm enjoying new reads. What is also refreshing is a guy who can't take himself too seriously when he's not wearing pants." boxers or briefs? Boxers. I don't know if you guys can hear that, but my wife is out in the other room, and she's cracking up right now. "Also, keep being you, John. This is great." Well, thank you so much. You guys are just so amazing. I really appreciate it. I mean, anybody that can listen to me go off, can listen to me just talk for an hour and 17 minutes on a podcast, I think it's amazing. I love you guys so much, and I don't want to just be a talking head talking to you. I want to interact with you. I want to be involved. I want to hear the things that you do also. I want to have a talking back and forth, a community. If you love this podcast, number one thing you can do to help grow this podcast is to give me ratings and reviews on iTunes, just like these wonderful people have done. You could also become a sponsor, become one of my Patreons, one of my patrons at patreon.com. Go to www.patreon.com/John Weldy. My website, once again, is reclaimingchristianity.net. My free book program, if you go to reclaimingchristianity.net, just click on free books and you will see it there. There is also a link to my online community that I set up this week. And talking about the free book program, I am 2 days away right now from a huge half-price book sale that is going to be going on at the fairgrounds in Indianapolis. I know I'm going to spend a good part of my day there on Friday, and every book is $2 or less, so I know I'm going to have some good things that I could share some of that love with you guys. I give away free books. The only thing that I ask for is that you help with – I only ask two things. Number one, that you read it. I don't want to give books to people that are just going to let them sit on their shelves. You don't have to report to me or anything like that, though. Just read it. Enjoy it. Love it. As much as I do. And number two, that you help out a little bit with shipping. If you really want books, but you can't afford to pay for the entire shipping fee, I mean, I get books really cheap. You know, honestly, if you pay a couple bucks for shipping and a couple bucks for a book, you probably covered my costs, you know? And if you want to kick in more than that, that's great. I love that. I've got people that kick in more than that and help me support the program. And I think that's absolutely wonderful. Every dollar that you put into this program goes right back into getting more books for people. But if you can't afford it, if you really, and I'm not gonna check your bank account or anything like that, but if you can't afford it, all I ask is that you give something for shipping, even if it's just a dollar, you know. So take advantage of that free book program. It's there for you. And like I said before, also, I have a book club coming up. If you're interested in a book club on Marcus Borg's Evolution of the Word, this is the entire New Testament in chronological order, not in the order that we have in the New Testament. It's in chronological order, and you can see how the New Testament evolves over the course of the 30 to 90 years that it was written and how things change from the beginning to the ending. And I would love to talk through this with some people. It's got some great commentary in it by Marcus Borg. If you're interested in that, just contact me in one of those ways to contact me that I gave you before. And so I'm going to sign off here right now. I love you guys. You guys are all amazing. And I just want to say at the end here, oh, one thing, next episode is going to be coming up soon. I haven't really decided. I'm going to be recording the next episode on Friday. I haven't really decided yet if I'm going to release it on Friday or if I'm going to wait until next Wednesday. I've been releasing every Wednesday. But the next episode, I'm going to have my first guest on the podcast. The guest is going to be Wayne Holmes, who is the founder of an organization I've been working with called Religious Recovery. This is not an anti-religious program at all. It's a program that understands that people are hurt by religion. There are a lot of people who have been hurt by religion, and either by religion or by the religious. And we just want to help process through some of that hurt and some of that pain. And it's going to be a great episode. It's going to be really neat. So that's going to be coming up on Friday in the next episode. And I may release it on Friday. I may release it next Wednesday. But so I'm going to sign off here right now. I'm John Weldy. I love all you guys. And I want to tell you that the most beautiful thing you can ever be is you. Do what you love. Love what you do. Thanks for listening.